Hello, this is David Gawke, Head of Public Policy at Macfarlane's, and welcome to the latest of our Policy in Practice podcasts. I'm delighted today to be joined by Zach Stein, who is co-founder and CEO of Carbon Collective, a US investment advisor. I'm also joined the home team by Rachel Richardson, Head of ESG at Macfarlane's, and Gavin Horan, Head of Policy for Asset Management. And today we are talking about investment management and decarbonisation, and what's the right approach. It's a very topical issue, attracted plenty of headlines and controversy of late. Zach, perhaps if we can start with you. First of all, just tell us a little bit about Carbon Collective and your approach to decarbonisation, in particular, interested in your views on the divestment debate.
Yes, we are an investment advisor that is based in the US. We help individuals and small businesses align their investments with truly solving climate change. We have a lot of views in this space. We came to it as outsiders, and so I'm really excited to engage in this. On divestment in particular, this is something that climate activist investors like us think about a lot of, should you go and engage oil companies because they are the source of a lot of climate change, or should you cut them out of your portfolio altogether? We very much land on the side of cut them out to our portfolio, and I'm happy to dig in why.
Let's hear the argument.
Okay. So when we think about what we need to do to solve climate change, we need to dramatically wind down the fossil fuel industry between now and 2050. Right now, we basically need to stop any new fossil fuel expansion. This is according to the International Energy Agency. There's no new oil fields that we need to drill to have a smooth transition to a net zero economy by 2050. So that's what the best science is telling us. So how can we use our investment dollars to get there? Let's go through the thought exercise of what happens if we engage a major oil company with that. And we go, and what happens if we win? What happens if we get one of the largest oil companies that's publicly traded in the world to say, okay, I'm going to become a solar company? What actual impact on emissions does that have? And it's likely going to be very low, if anything, because they're not going to announce, hey, oil is a terrible business to be in all of a sudden, because they want to give a return to their shareholders. They're going to quietly sell those assets, those oil fields, those mineral rights, et cetera. They're not going to do a fire sale. So they're not going to bring down the whole industry with them. So that means they're going to quietly divest from it, which means someone is going to buy those sites. And so long as there is demand for fossil fuels, then a private entity, a government-based entity, is going to work those sites, and we're not going to see any difference in actual carbon emissions. So focusing on getting oil companies to change, and there are things to improve, like flaring and stuff like that, but focusing on getting these companies to change, especially when they've often proven to be fairly bad actors, and in coordination, there's often a like, okay, just get off our back approach. It makes way less sense to focus on supply than focus on demand. I'll give one quick analogy. Right now, oil, it's like they're at a store, and the guy behind the counter has a line out the door of customers. And so going to the guy behind the counter and saying, hey, you should really consider changing businesses to maybe being a solar company, doesn't really make much sense. Instead, we should go to the line and say, hey, I think you can get a much better deal across the street, and it's better for the planet. So that's our strategy of, we need to be focusing on reducing demand for fossil fuels and ignoring supply. Supply will follow.
I suppose others would say that, and I'm the first person to agree with a lot of what you've said there, Zach, but others would say that the current energy providers, some of them do have transition plans. Quick query how credible they are. And I know that some out there seem to rely on technologies that might perhaps be unproven at this stage where we are today. However, some people would argue that the current energy providers are transitioning themselves and that they do have a plan for the future, and those current energy providers are the best ones to do that transition, and that to be realistic about where we are today, they will have a place going forwards. It will just be the those that are at the head of the market, at the head of the transition, that will survive. I don't know what you think about those views.
Yeah, there are some examples of companies being way ahead of it. There is a company in Europe that divested from all of its oil fields and switched to being a wind energy company, and its stock has done incredibly well since then. They're way ahead of it. It was a mid-sized company, oil company, in doing this. The problem with overly relying upon that, with that transition, is that it doesn't necessarily fit that long-term thinking does not necessarily fit the economic environment and the pressures that these boards and CEOs are placed under. They need to deliver profits every 90 days. Another company is currently being sued in the UK because 96% of its investment, despite its advertisements, which make it look very much different, are going towards expanding their fossil fuel operations rather than investing in that low carbon transition. So when we actually see that investment, that's where people like me are going to start to get a lot of hope, and we would consider bringing them into our portfolios. But talk is very cheap in this space. It's much, much cheaper for these organizations to put forth a marketing campaign than to actually make that change. And so it's actions that we need to see before we can look at this and not say, this just looks like the same greenwashing we've been seeing before.
Matt, what do you say to the argument that, look, there's still going to be plenty of demand for fossil fuels? You know, events around Ukraine have demonstrated that, that there are still going to be investors who are willing to invest in fossil fuels, even if, you know, many investors won't do that. You know, many still will. What difference does it make if, you know, you and your clients are divesting, if others are still investing? How does that really transform things? Because the demand is still going to be there for the products.
It's such a good question. And I think that this is something that climate activists and greenies like me do not acknowledge. Our world was built by fossil fuels. Full stop. The fact that I'm able to record this podcast with you today is because of fossil fuels. The unbelievable amounts of energy that has been able to release has been incredibly impactful and has done some amazing things, along with some very terrible things. When we look at the future of this industry, what we see at Carbon Collective is an industry that is fundamentally in decline. That a lot of it is not going to go away overnight. This is what we are seeing in Ukraine and in the crisis. Our world still, unfortunately, is dependent upon fossil fuels for its main energy source. But that is changing. Let's give an example here in the U.S. Over half of the oil that is consumed in the U.S. is on our roadways. It's in our cars and trucks. We now have a technology that is fundamentally better to do that. It is faster, stronger, roomier, quieter, more convenient. It costs a tenth as much to maintain, and it's going to cost as much to buy as a gas-powered car within the next 5 years. It's an electric car. We are in the middle of a technological transition. This is like when we switched from film to digital cameras. With that fundamentally, oil-powered cars are being outcompeted, regardless of what you think about climate change. It's just better. It's a better driving experience that is already cheaper over its lifetime, and it's going to be cheaper to drive up front soon. So that's a lot of market share that's going down. Same thing when we look in electricity. Solar, wind, and batteries are the cheapest form of generating electricity in many places around the world today, and that's only increasing as these industries continue to expand. So when we look at it, this is what I think the key part of the divestment movement needs to be from a financial perspective, is you're right. There are going to be people, especially short-term investors, that are going to look at the energy industry and see, how can I make a buck? But it's the long-term investors, the institutionals, that the divestment movement will be successful when they, who have no ethical mandate, say it is time to divest because we no longer see a future in this industry. I'll give one more quick example of how that narrative shift could be really powerful. From 2011 to 2020, the Dow Jones U.S. Coal Index fell 99% over that time. 99%. That is a massive drop over that time. And it's not that we stopped using coal. We unfortunately still use it for electricity in the U.S. and beyond. In some areas, it's growing. It's that investors, the narrative around coal changed. It went from being something that was relatively stable in your portfolio and could be somewhat countercyclical to saying, there is no long-term business model in this. It's being replaced by gas. It's being replaced by solar and wind. And what happened to the price, the cost of capital for those companies? It became a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you're a CEO and your stock price drops 99%, it becomes way harder to go to a bank and say, please, I want to go, you know, blow the top off a new mountain. So that is the argument that we believe is going to be the most impactful we can make. It has to be greenies like us that say, yes, we're doing this for ethical reasons, but we're also doing it because we think it's a smarter way to invest. And that is a key part of the theory of change. And for groups like Carbon Collective and beyond, is how do we get those non-ethically moted asset managers?
Can I just come back to the point I was making earlier in terms of this, which is, look, unless governments intervene, unless, for example, they use levers like a carbon tax and so on, some investors may divest. But if the demand is still there from the public, if there is still a kind of on a pure business case basis, a good return on investment into, let us say, fossil fuels. It's still going to happen, isn't it? It's still, and all the divestment in the world, assuming that it's not, not complete, not everybody, you're still going to have a sort of fossil fuel industry if it makes economic sense, if there's still a return.
Absolutely. That is going to be the case. And when we're thinking about long-term investors, especially in these companies' stocks, what I think the underlying assumption that you have there is that fossil fuels are a necessary evil for performance in a portfolio. And that so long as that continues to be the case, regardless of what's happening in terms of the world of climate, if there's money to be made there, investors will hold these companies. So there's kind of, when we look backwards at that assumption, it is increasingly proven to be false. If you had divested from the year I was born, 1989, up until the present from fossil fuels, from the S&P 500, you would have generated a greater return than if you had held the S&P 500 over together. That's a 32-year period. Yes, I just aged myself with that. It's not a significantly different one, but it is. Different. And so that argument that fossil fuels, regardless of what you feel, are this necessary countercyclical importance for performance has not been true. The past 10 years have been abysmal in particular for fossil fuels, even with only in the last year did it come back into the black. It's where we all have these short-term memories in investing. And then, that's in the past 30 years. Now let's look to the next 30 years with it. That's where we see these trends of saying, okay, from a long-term investing perspective, let's ignore what industry we're talking about. Would you prefer to be invested in an industry that is getting outcompeted in multiple areas of its historic dominance or the industries that are replacing them? It would be the latter one. And so that is the argument that I think we need to broadly make. And there's going to be people who are trading in short term with that. The same thing that happened in coal. With that, it is the long-term thesis of saying the macro trends here point towards this not being an industry that makes sense to hold in an institutional level portfolio or a retirement type portfolio that's looking over the long term. The asset classes that have that long-term view are quite significant, especially in public markets, and that could be very impactful.
Gavin, do you want to come in on that?
Yeah, if I could, and just broaden the discussion around the sort of economics of decarbonisation. I mean, one of the criticisms that some people make is that decarbonisation has a negative economic impact more broadly on the sort of macro level, but more specifically to the poorest people in society. And how do you, Zach, as an investor, think about that, the broader impacts of your company's activity. But also, I suppose the question underlying that is, how do you trade off between the different ESG objectives? You're obviously focused on decarbonization, but you've also got social impacts to think about, people's employment, their living standards. How do you as a company take account of all of that?
Yeah, so we are focused on climate change. We think it is the number one driver of basically all of those metrics right now. It is the number one risk to all of them, to the sustainability of our environment, to what is happening socially. 1 million people die per year from air pollution. Air pollution is caused by burning stuff. That is what drives our world right now. Look at Cancer Alley in Louisiana. We solve climate change, that goes away. The world where we solve climate change to decarbonize is a much better world, especially for areas where a lot of pollution is housed today, the poorer areas of the world that have the dirty power plants in them or have the oil refinery sites in them. When those industries are no longer needed, think back to the beginning of COVID, when we saw those images from around the world of like cities in India where you could see the Himalayas for like the first time in 30 years. That is what the world looks like when we solve climate change. It is a fundamentally better world. So especially when we think about from that social piece, there is just many, many cascading benefits there. Now, there is ways for, you know, wealth inequality to only increase because there's significant opportunity in solving climate change to be made. There's a lot of money to be made here. A lot of what we see is that this is going to fundamentally raise GDP, like the IEA's 20 report of net zero by 2050 argues that this is a fundamentally net positive for what we're doing. And this is when, especially when you imagine economically, let's zoom into the micro. When you invest in a solar farm or a wind farm, it has this high capex upfront, but then the opex is incredibly minimal. And you just get to use that energy onwards. And when we look at oil, it's a lot of the opposite, especially when we look at getting to new sites. The capex just keeps going up for new sites. And as we're picking all of the low-hanging fruit with it, because we're picking the easy-to-extract sites, and the opex does too, because like fracking is way more expensive than drilling for oil in Saudi Arabia. And that only gets more and more true over time. It was estimated that a third of inflation is due to the rising cost of energy extraction right now. And that's bad for everyone economically.
And things like the capex of solar technology, for example, is going down year on year as we scale up production and as new technologies come to market and we have more providers, et cetera, et cetera. So that's going to keep going down, we all hope.
Yes, yes. When we look at solar and wind and electric cars, there are some supply chain bottlenecks that need to be solved. Those are really important. But fundamentally, the problem of those industries is a manufacturing problem. And we are, if we're really good at one thing, as in our hyper-capitalistic world, is solving manufacturing problems and getting those costs down and down and down and down. We get better and better and better at it. And that's kind of the exponential factor that is one of the things that gives me the greatest hope in solving climate change, is we have this. We also have these other broader economic trends, because everything we're talking about is without any climate legislation with it. Anything that happens on that is just going to be a cherry on top for pushing this transition faster. But the broad economics, and that's the argument that, again, we as people who are divesting want to make, think it just makes a lot more sense. And I'll add one point here of what is the impact that you can have from divesting. And this goes to the long term and the short term. As if you're holding a stock or a series of stocks, I'm holding 1,000 shares of an oil company in my retirement fund for the long term, I've effectively removed the supply of those shares from the actively traded market. So it's almost as if they've gone away in terms of setting up share price. Versus when I divest, I put those back out into the pool. And the traders that are going to be trading in the short term on a daily basis, that's going to increase the supply of overall shares traded. So when demand goes down, because of that higher supply, the price will also go down. And so price does impact cost of capital for these companies, especially when we can have these very big swings. So I kind of think about it like in these long-term things, it's like a storage unit or something like that for these stocks. And it's, what do we want in our storage units for what could have that impact? And we have to make the financial argument is where we're going. That's the tipping point in the divestment movement for in long-term investing.
I guess that sort of responds to the argument, does it, that you know, if you invest in public markets, it doesn't have much of an impact because of the lack of additionality. You're refinancing someone else's original investment. But your point is that that's sending a sort of, you know, if that drives the price down, then that is making a difference.
Yeah, this is one of the big arguments against divestment, which is saying that, hey, the stocks and bonds that you're buying, they're used. The stock market is much closer to eBay than it is to like a retail store. Everything is used. So what is the actual impact of that? And it does have, the secondary market does have a significant impact. Just look at, why do boards and the C-suite of companies care so much about their stock price? If it didn't have any impact, then they would just completely ignore it and focus on the long-term for their business model. But it's maybe the most important thing that they pay attention to is the day-to-day movement of that stock price. It's really critical. And it comes again to that cost of capital. I think that this is best illustrated by the example that I gave of the coal index falling with that. It's so extreme, it makes it really easy to take hold of that when your stock falls 99%. And the industry that you're in is seen at in the macroeconomic sense, that the narrative has shifted underneath you, then it becomes really hard to expand your business in that. And so that's the impact that the secondary market can have. It becomes more expensive for those companies to sell new stock on the primary market of selling new equity for that. They have to guarantee, they have to, you know, showcase a much higher return that they'll give for that. And they have to bend over backwards a lot more. They have to allocate more to paying for those shares, or raising debt from that is also, they're going to have a much higher interest rate because of their lower credit rating.
And I suppose with my former debt lawyer hat on, what I would hope happens is that an originator of, say, some sort of green debt, bond, loan, whatever it might be, that they would be investing on day one, selling it to someone like USAC in the secondary market. And then presumably, if they are operating a green or sustainability strategy, they then do their next deal with the money that you have given them to buy their debt. So I suppose it overall increases the amount of capital that we have within the sort of green finance world. And therefore, the overall effect is positive and at some point additional, albeit I do understand the issues of additionality and sort of appreciate them.
Correct. Yeah. What I said kind of ignores that when you have an asset that is seen as quite positive, you can leverage it and you could literally create money in order to do it and expand something. That is what the system of banking and of governments that we have is basically built upon, that tenet. And so that could be a really powerful tool of pushing forward the climate action that we need. Because we already talked about one side of what we need to do to solve climate change, which is we need to wind down the fossil fuel industry to a fraction of what it is today by 2050, largely being that fossil fuels are largely used to create plastics. That's, again, according to the IEA with that, which is, you know, the emissions for that are much lower. The other thing that we have to do is we have to dramatically increase annual investments into climate solutions. We need to be investing somewhere between $5 to $9 trillion per year into climate solutions around the globe. And right now, as of 2019 was the last data I saw, we had invested $600 billion that year. So we need a 10 to 20 fold increase in annual investments into climate solutions. And this is not altruism. A lot of these investments can make their investors a lot of money, but it's part of that narrative that needs to shift. This is the other narrative. We talked about one, that fossil fuels are a necessary evil for a balanced portfolio. The other narrative is that sustainable investing is fundamentally a charitable act, that people like me do it to feel better about ourselves, and we accept a few points, a lower return. And we believe that that is just not true. It is a smarter way to invest, and it's better for the world.
So in which case, Zach, why isn't there the the investment that you argue that we need? Is it just that collectively the markets are getting it wrong?
I think that the markets don't fully see the level of transition that we are in right now. It is hard to recognize a technological transition when you are in the middle of one. We're still in the early adopter phases of it with the transition to electrification and things like that. But we're seeing kind of the early adopter pools of capital, like climate tech VC is the hottest area of VC. I'm in California. We're a VC-backed company. Some of the largest levels of capital right now are coming into this space. Some of the largest new private investment funds are coming out and looking at investments into this. It is really hard to find good places, the really high return places to put money into renewable energy anymore. You can still get good returns, but the great returns, there's in some areas, there's more capital chasing deals. We've now reached that point. So we're starting to see capital catch up here, but we still need that broader narrative. There's way more.
Sorry, I agree with you, Zach. I think just to sort of fill in a little bit there, I think we've got a little bit of a gap. I think there's a lot of appetite, David. There's vast amounts of appetite, and the investment is going in the VC world, as you were saying, Zach. I think that there are some technologies which are not yet proven enough for other types of investment manager, so not the VCs of this world, but other investment manager types to invest in yet. And I think we're sort of on the precipice of some of those technologies being investable by those sorts of funds. But I think we're in this sort of difficult stage for some of the reasons that Zach mentioned, whereby the kind of the really big pot of capital isn't quite there, but it's just about to get there with some of the technologies that we really need financing.
Yeah, those pots of capital move really slowly. That's part of how they operate. It's part of their mandate. Previously, there was liquidity issues for those pots of capital to be able to enter things like renewable energy. It's just the level of shares being traded and the market caps of these companies were too low for these companies, for these asset managers to be able to take the level of stakes that they need to from a mandate perspective, because then they were worried that they'd get stuck, that if they had to sell, they would actually move the market in selling. In doing that. And so that's part of, again, where that cost of capital and where us changing what's in our storage units can actually help and start to unlock and reverse that cycle with it. We can unlock for these asset managers that are saying, hey, my hands are tied and I'm sitting on the sidelines here, even though I want to do this from a financial perspective, I can't yet jump into the pool. But that's changing.
Can I just ask, in terms of, your focus is obviously the perspective of investors, interested in terms, if you have any sort of particular views on what public policy levers should be used here. You sort of set out an approach to some extent that doesn't involve or doesn't require government to play a big role if all kind of goes to plan. But what would you say if you were advising governments? What would you be telling them to do? Is it carbon tax? What is it?
Yeah, let me clarify. It's to solve climate change, it is very much a yes and again here. And so part of the economic argument that I'm very careful to make in this is that regardless of what happens legislatively, there are broader macroeconomic forces that are underway that are somewhat unstoppable. The train is coming downhill with it, and it's picking up speed. It doesn't need additional pushes from the government for these certain areas, like electric cars, like renewable energy and batteries right now. There's certainly ways that government could help. Let me give an example right now. There is right now in the US enough renewable energy in the queue to be added to the grid that could power the entire US. Wow, that's a crazy thought. There's a huge bottleneck right now in getting that. Only about a quarter of those projects will likely make it through to being able to get approved to connect to the grid. The grid is a major bottleneck to be able to make this transition and do that fast enough. And that is something where the private sphere can only do so much. You can innovate around the edges. We can get cheaper batteries, move more things onto microgrids, do all these clever things around it. But fundamentally, the role of government is to set the rules of the playing field that business plays in. They spray paint the lines onto the pitch, as you would say. And it's for private to be able to play it. And so they're moving those lines is going to be really important. So in areas like renewable energy, specific policy to cut red tape and make it easier and incentivize the grid to be upgraded, to make it smarter and be able to more easily integrate renewables, but in particular energy storage with that is going to be really, really key. Broader things like a carbon tax, absolutely. From that, we absolutely need it. Some of the risk there is that there could be an over-reliance potentially on carbon offsets, which as a market is still quite nascent in growing and learning with it. Having incentives to do things that are like true carbon removal and significant investments in that could be really, really significant. So from the government, yes, we absolutely, but we should be trying it all and seeing what happens. But we also, there's very specific issues where we could say, this is a clear area where the economics make sense. This is not altruism. This is going to help the economy. This is going to help growth. And the government right now, in the way that the rules are structured, it's getting in its own way of just letting this industry flourish.
The UK government earlier on this month, they pulled their grant scheme for electric vehicles in the UK. And that's because they are now so adopted by users in the UK that it's no longer necessary. So that's a great example of government policy and intervention doing exactly what you've said. It now makes economic sense to go out and buy an EV without a government subsidy.
Exactly. And so maybe that government subsidy could be shifted towards electrifying your home. Maybe it's towards installing an electric powered heater, a heat pump, or an induction stove, or changing your dryer to switch from gas to electric. So there's these other areas, because, you know, heat pumps can pay for themselves, but induction stoves don't quite yet. So these other areas, we're having that to get over the finish line with it, because especially for those type of things, homeowners, you only change your stove out like once every 20 years or something like that. And so you really want to catch people when they're making that decision to make that switch. And then when we talk about things like Ukraine, the less gas we're using, the better.
And I suppose we do need more international agreements. So you know, we need a proper carbon tax. We need a border adjustment mechanism. But we do need the large nations to come together and agree what that might look like. So that would be on my wish list, David.
So I suppose a point for the asset management industry as a whole. What advice would you give the industry in terms of adapting their businesses and portfolios to help support the climate? What's the sort of the one piece of advice you would give others?
Fear and greed. Their climate is the scariest thing that we are facing economically. And it is also one of the greatest opportunities, probably the greatest opportunity of our time to get ahead of and make a significant return from that. But it necessitates a true embracing and a look and going outside of what everyone else is doing. This is not a time to kind of be looking too much at what your neighbors are doing. This is a time to lead. And those who make the bold bets now, not everyone will pay off, but you're going to be much better positioned to protect your assets because climate change is here and it is impacting our economy. That is what I think the future of ESG is going to be. It is going to be, yes, we need to push these companies, but it's also just saying, how exposed am I to water risk as the rainfall patterns change in my portfolio? That's the type of questions that investors need to be asking. And then where are the opportunities within that? So fear and greed around climate is what we need to be able to achieve the type of transition we need at the level of scale and speed we need to have by 2050.
Good. Well, on that note, fear and greed, we'll bring this podcast to an end. Zach, thank you very much for joining us from California. The wonders of science means that's a lot easier to do these days than it once was. Can I thank Rachel and Gavin, my McFarlane's colleagues. I hope that's been a very interesting podcast. That certainly has, from my perspective, been really fascinating. Thank you for that, Zach. And thanks for tuning in. And do listen to the next in our series of Policy in Practice podcasts. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.